because actually the whole issue about sacrifice as it comes up
yes.
from Tilak to Gandhi
yeah.
to everyone else.
Yes.
This is actually a critique of liberals.
Mm-hmm.
And it is therefore a different kind of mounting of political thought from the one you're suggesting.
Mm.
So in that sense, actually, even I haven't read Neethi's book, but that kind of, I would imagine, is a very different cut into what you are saying.
Mm-hmm.
You're using the word. I'm not quite clear of the moorings of your word because sacrifice, whether you look at Skaria's work, whether whole new turn in Indian political thought on looking at sacrifice, places it as a hegemonic critique of liberalism.
Well, in this case, perhaps then I would try to argue that this is perhaps an interesting different stream in which sacrifice is taken, although which is in a sense classically liberal as well, as in it actually rejects specific community-based identity claims and goes for what you can see as fairly orthodox kind of constitutional politics. They may well have actually borrowed, once again, so to say, from Gandhian ideas, which they actually, it's not a conjecture, they very specifically refer to Gandhian ideas of sacrifice, when Paul certainly does when he actually talks about Christian citizenship. But the point really is that the message he takes away from that for his community is the one that shapes the kind of community political shaping. So what I'm really interested in is how the leaders of a certain community actually shape themselves politically. And it's admitted that they themselves use the language of sacrifice and service, deriving it clearly from broader sources, but take it in a different direction.
Thank you. Along the way, you used the word protest to talk about these people and talked about it as a politics of protest, I think. And I was wondering how that sort of ties in together with the institutional story that you're telling us, because obviously there was this idea of the ashram, but the ashram doesn't materialize. Instead, we have the YMCA instead. And so effectively, it sort of goes from protest to something which is not protest at all. It's a sort of much broader sort of umbrella structure of institutions, which you might say it's sort of an Indian YMCA, but the YMCA is, as far as I understand it, much wider than that. So I wonder whether you could kind of reflect on that, reflect on why the ashram didn't sort of come about, as well, and why we end up with the YMCA, and also what that indicates about the sort of limits of this program. And related to that, I wanted to kind of ask you a second question, which is, well, I mean, surely there is sectarianism out there as well. I mean, you're telling the story of sort of rejection of sectarianism amongst Indian Christians. Yes. Is there a sort of sectarian story as well, and how does that fit?
Okay, so to come to the first one, I think the theological criticism has to be seen in the context of what these people are kind of chafing against, and therefore what they're trying to reverse. So in a very broad sense, it is a rhetorical strategy, and not necessarily the kind of roots of an alternative ecclesiastical or kind of religious structure. I mean, that really does, I mean, there are isolated attempts to set up things like that, and arguably perhaps Brahma Bandhav actually discovers his ashram in Shantiniketan. And one of the arguments that Paul makes in his speech as well is that it's a possibility. But as you say, he's actually, instead, he creates something which kind of institutionally mirrors the older structures. However, he does very actively try to reverse what that thing which continuously irritates these people, which is the racial hierarchy, which he does arguably manage to achieve to a very significant extent in this particular institution. So I do think that it is a rhetorical strategy, and in that, which is sincere nevertheless, and I think that it's kind of non-functionality is not the point, but the strength of that argument and the kinds of things that it allows people then to do, and the kind of moral strength it gives them to do that is what's important in that sense. Okay, as for the sectarian argument, yes, of course, I mean, there is the very strong sectarian argument, and that is actually the vast majority of people, given which I think it's well, I think it's even more interesting that this group of people can actually make a kind of convincing argument and emerge as these national leaders. There is a simple explanation that it is due to external endorsement. But I think the coherence of their position, which they take for a very long time, should push us at least to think that this is not entirely a derivative position, that there are kind of internal and coherent and kind of systematic ways of both looking at church, theology, social structure, etc., the things that really bother them, that lead them to that particular political position. So that's the answer, which is why I did actually try and present the kind of, if you like, rabid sectarian view as well. Even in 1947, the AICIC passes a resolution against separate electorates, but the entire meeting actually says that that's a pity. But nevertheless, that's the resolution that gets passed. And so it's the story of the successful, if you like.
Could you say a little bit about electorates more generally? That's to say, particularly the issue of suffrage, because I'm sure the whole notion of citizenship at this period depends upon the extension of suffrage. And if we have this kind of division between the Dalit and the elite, how do they deal with that issue?
There's that moment in the late 1920s when there is a discussion, which I think it's significant that discussion does not recur again, which is whether Christians are Christians or Christians are depressed classes, talking of the vast majority of Dalit Christians. And there is a very small number of similarly placed kind of Christian leaders who do suggest that perhaps they ought to be both. And that would address social reality much more accurately than the view that the church does not recognize caste, and therefore Christians don't have caste, and they need not be bothered with that issue, and they can go on and discuss the issue about religious representation. That kind of bubbles up, as far as I've seen, only about once, and then disappears out of the story. Partly also because it has endorsement from more theologically conservative Christians as well, such as, for example, Azaria, who does not share these kind of liberal theological visions, but nevertheless thinks that specific political privileges for Dalit Christians is going to create a kind of comb-like structure, which is not what they want. They want an expansive church. And therefore, the point is religion, not social division.
See, I got that point, but I was interested in at what point your institutions were calling for universal suffrage.
Interestingly enough, from what I've seen of the AICIC's minutes, they don't. They don't discuss the point at all. That's not a major agenda point for them. On the other hand, Paul actually discusses that in detail. Paul writes about British relationship with India in a specific book, and he seems to take this, once again, this very old liberal vision that it's possible for India to be part of empire, provided certain conditions are fulfilled, as in it's not a dominant kind of partnership, and that requires extension of suffrage as well. So he does actually bring that up. But the organization itself actually does not discuss it. I mean, the dominant line of argumentation is how to represent religion rather than how to actually represent at all.
I wonder if I might ask a question. I wanted to know a little bit about the YMCA. You gave a full account towards the end of how that influenced London, how there were changes in structures and so forth. But I wonder, I know Azariah was also a member of the YMCA, but seems to have taken a kind of different political discourse in his life. Was it simply an organisation for the meeting of minds, and people chose different ways, or was there some sense of direction coming from the leadership? And if so, where was that located?
There was actually a moment in 1927 when the European Association of Calcutta actually accused the YMCA of sedition. So you have that moment of racial split in the YMCA, except that it doesn't split. It's the entire thing is said to have gone in an anti-British direction. And this very right-wing accusation also says that is derived directly from American patronage and so on. a lot of it was bluster. So I'm not really convinced that, in fact, the American patrons in question necessarily had quite the same views of radical nationalism that they were actually accused of. But the fact remains, however, that when you actually look at activities of the YMCA, you see the same names recurring again and again, such that when they need a lecture delivered, they call Manilal Parikh, who may not be a major establishment figure in the church, but is a very prominent speaker in the circles. And so there is, as far as direction is concerned, one does look at the national secretaries, mm-hmm. and these are the men that I've just been talking about, and their views are very clear.
So not just about equalizing relations with the CMS missionaries, but how far you see them sort of conceptualizing themselves as part of a global communion, reaching out to other Christians in other parts of the world, and how far rather they are concentrated on these sort of very national concerns. And thinking about earlier on in your story when you were talking about these articles which talked about Indians being particularly ready for Christianity, whether perhaps they see themselves as in a better position or with more potential for Christian fulfillment than other new converts in the world?
Well, explicitly at least, the kind of ethnicized view of religion, as in a national religion, so to say, is one that these leaders completely reject. So they constantly keep referring upon the point of how, in spite of all their faults, they cannot actually let go of their missionary friends and tutors and so on, and that they might actually have some specific, a very particular empathy with other people in the world. And this is very personal as well. I mean, they do actually travel quite widely. And very important experience for them is very often traveling around Asia. And looking at other kind of Asian Christian contexts. Therefore, I mean, I think that remains in kind of tension. And this is something that they reflect upon as well. I mean, and it's the issue of ethnicity and nationalism is not just vis-a-vis the Western missionaries, but it is also vis-a-vis our brothers in kind of other countries. And that brotherhood is, at least it's never rhetorically rejected. But on the other hand, it seems almost by kind of silence, the kind of like the problem that they ought to somehow, which is suggested to them, for instance, that they ought to behave in a more religiously restricted fashion, but they kind of assert much more a kind of Indian role, so to say. So I think those, you know, the answer is that it's in kind of tension, so to say.
Well, first, I just wanted to ask who this Cambridge Mudgley student was who won the violent revolution. And this is what I think is sort of an interesting point. And second of all, I'm still somewhat confused about the use of the term political theology. Because it, you seem to be saying that this is just simply sort of a, you know, instrumental rhetorical exercise, especially the these evocations of sacrifice, etc., really for sort of standard liberal sort of ends, whether it's in terms of identity or community or sort of political reservations or whatnot. I mean, but it seems to be actually there may be theologically based institutions, you know, having something of a politics, but not necessarily a political theology involved to it. So I'm just wondering about what you really mean by that.
I think the kind of inspiration for calling it political theology comes very much out of people like Paul's exposition of the idea of Christian citizenship, where he explicitly rejects just what you have described, which is an association based on a certain confessional identity is not a Christian citizenship institution of Christian citizenship. Christian citizenship is about the ethical derivatives of a theological position. Okay, so he's not particularly theologically sophisticated. So were you a theologian, it would be quite easy to actually take a lot of them apart on intellectual grounds. However, these are arguments that they sort of consistently make and borrow from each other as well, saying that their confession somehow lends itself towards certain ethical positions. And having said that, I'm not sure that it can be entirely understood to be a kind of instrumentalist kind of bridge towards standard liberal positions. If nothing, because it is not entirely a standard liberal position. They are, after all, a minority community, and they're aware of that as well. And they're reflecting on that as well. But they are actually saying that this kind of hyper-liberal position is one that their specific kind of doctrinal background, as interpreted by themselves, undoubtedly borrowing from other sources, lends them to a kind of general leadership. I mean, there is similar reflection. I mean, it's very casual, but there is similar reflection in Abul Kalam Azad's work, as in being Muslim means that you can take general leadership as well, and it doesn't have to be a Muslim country for you to in order to do that. But as I said, very much in the passing, and that's the kind of derivation they're making. So if you're actually if you wanted to kind of critique that view, as in this is bad theology, no doubt it is. I mean, some of them are terrible, and the kind of analogies and implications they draw out are very questionable. But the point is that there's a pattern to this, and they convince themselves, in a sense, that these are, in fact, the implications of being Christian.
And the Cambridge student?
I've forgotten his name, but I send you the whatever. He's a Muslim student, and it's the Indian. He's the Cambridge Muslims' president, in fact.
Well, thank you very much once again for answering our questions. Before we go, I'd like to remind you that we meet again this time next week, I believe, in the same room. Again, a topic connected with Indian Christianity, and Duane Menezes will speak about Kerala Catholics and their religious institutions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.